and now a reporter's notebook. In the war on terror, there is no more strategically important front than Pakistan. Since 9/11, Pakistan has been hailed as a loyal ally and denounced as an unreliable client. A previously cozy relationship with the Taliban was abruptly jettisoned in favor of the United States-led anti-terror coalition, but relationships between some officials there and Islamic militants are said to still be very strong. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR senior intelligence correspondent, just returned from a two-week reporting trip to Pakistan and joins us here in Studio 3A to talk about it. If you have questions for her about Pakistan's delicate role in the war on terror or what it's like to report from that country, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Mary Louise, nice to see you back.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Neil.
You were in Pakistan 10 years ago. I wonder, what have you noticed that's changed?
Well, in terms of the big strategic issues, it's a totally different ball game. I mean, back in 96, when I was last there, Pakistan had not tested a nuclear weapon. Nobody had heard of Osama bin Laden. So in terms of U.S. interests in and concern about Pakistan, it was a very different trip. In terms of, you know, people's daily lives, and obviously you have to be careful not to generalize too much based on what you see in 2 weeks, but clearly, you know, a few of the things you notice, everybody's got a cell phone. Everybody is text messaging. Most people who I spoke to seem to have access to satellite news. They watch Fox News. They watch Desperate Housewives on satellite. McDonald's has opened. You can get a fillet of fish now in Pakistan. On the other hand, you know, seeing this country through Western eyes, it is still desperately poor. The cities that I returned to that I'd seen before, Rawalpindi, Islamabad, Peshawar in the north, seemed more crowded, more polluted. And the security situation, of course, is very different post 9/11. I mean, every day I would wake up in my hotel and turn to the local papers, and it seemed like every day there was a new report of some suicide bombing or missile attack or roadside bomb. So the security situation is very difficult. While I was there, there was a suicide bombing that killed dozens of people at an army base that really upset people in Pakistan. Of course, it was the first time they felt like their Pakistani security services had been targeted, and it really stoked fears that perhaps the war that they watch across the border in Afghanistan is starting to spill into their own country.
In 10 years ago, there were many hundreds of thousands of Afghan refugees living in camps in Pakistan. Are they still there? Most
of
them have left.
They have tried their best to repatriate. It's hard to get a precise number on how many people you're talking about, but the number that officials will tell you in Pakistan is that at the height of the refugee crisis, there was something like 5 million living in Pakistan. Couple million have gone back, but that still leaves you with 3 million. And many of those people are people from the Soviet war back in the 80s. So people who have now been there 20 years, 30 years, they've raised families, they perhaps have married, you know, they've built a life in Pakistan. It does not look like they have any idea of wanting to go back. And yet you drive through these camps and they are horrific. Places, you know, no electricity, no running water in many of them, and no real way to get out and no real way to persuade these people to leave, which is what Pakistan would like to see happen.
As you say, some Pakistanis look across the border and fear that the war they see there spreading back into their country, it is a war, to some degree, of their creation.
Yes, and that's a question you have to bear in mind as you interview people in Pakistan about the current situation and Pakistan's current efforts in the war on terror is very much the history dating back, well, of course, many, many years, but specifically, of course, to the days when the Soviet Union was invading and occupying Afghanistan, and then U.S. and Pakistani efforts and role in all of that. They will point to, Pakistani officials today will point to many of their problems and say, this is Afghanistan's fault. So they look at the terrorism issue and the problems and suicide bombings we mentioned along the border. I had senior government officials say, the recent suicide bombings in Peshawar, that is Afghanistan. And I sort of said, do you mean the Taliban? They said, no, Karzai's government is sending suicide bombers to Peshawar. Senior government officials saying this on the record. I mean, I was startled the degree to which you hear that from all walks of life in Pakistan.
You also hear senior Afghan officials, including the president, say, those Pakistanis, they're sending suicide bombers into Afghanistan.
Yeah, they say that the Taliban fighters are able to fall back across the border, recover, get medical treatment, get supplies, and then they come back and attack U.S., NATO, and Afghan troops.
And it's hard to refute their logic. They're coming from someplace.
And Pakistanis look at that and say, we have 80,000 troops along the border. What are you doing on the other side? There are two sides to a border. Why is every problem in terms of border crossing, why is it all our problem? You know, you've got U.S. and NATO troops with incredible technology and resources we don't have on the other side. What are you doing on your side? So it's interesting to hear it argued very, very different lines on this coming out of Islamabad and then coming out of Kabul.
But those newly resurgent Taliban forces fighting in Afghanistan are getting weapons, training, food from someplace. You look at the map and it can't be any other place.
Well, and this is one of the real questions I was looking at when I was there was trying to figure out what exactly the situation is in the tribal areas, which are technically within Pakistan's border. There are 7 tribal areas. They're in the mountains. They have never been under the control of Pakistan's central government. They are today areas where journalists can't go for the most part. Aid workers can't really go. Large parts of them now denied to Pakistan's own army. When I was able to cross into them, you go with the tribal police. Pakistani mm-hmm. security forces can't cross the line. And so it's a very real issue trying to figure out who exactly these people are. I kept asking, who's behind these attacks? Is this the Taliban? Is this Pakistani extremists? Is this foreign fighters, allied with al-Qaeda? And it's very difficult and very murky to try to separate who exactly is fighting who there and where exactly they're getting the resources from.
Let's get some callers on the line for Mary Louise Kelly. And this is John. John's with us from Surprise, Arizona.
Hi there. I vary between amusement and outrage when I think about Dr. Khan, the Pakistani who was Johnny Appleseed in providing nuclear weapon materials for Libya, North Korea, etc., got an immediate amnesty, and he appears to be the person about whom no one talks, and the U.S. treats him like a polar bear in the corner of the room, which you never admit is there. What really is the story behind that story?
AQ Khan, and don't leave Iran off the list. But anyway, go ahead.
Right. AQ Khan is now under house arrest in Islamabad. He was, as you say, granted an official pardon. And when I asked around it, there is no sense in Pakistan that he is ever going to face any further legal proceedings, that he will ever be brought to justice in the way that I think many Americans would like to see happen. Mm. Or that any of his associates will be. And, you know, you have to realize from the Pakistani government's point of view, he is revered in Pakistan. I talked to a bunch of people, not just government officials, but ordinary people, you know, in the street, in the markets, at the universities, trying to figure out their sense of him. He is revered for his earlier role in terms of making Pakistan a nuclear power at a stage when that country felt like they had to be for its very survival because India, its arch rival, was moving forward with a nuclear weapon. AQ Khan brought the nuclear bomb to Pakistan, and Pakistanis love him for it. And it is seen as an issue where if the Pakistani government pressed and were to try to send this man to prison or were even to try to allow, say, U.S. interrogators to question him, that is something that could stoke anti-government, anti-Musharraf, and that's the president of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, to a point where you could potentially see that government topple or at least see very, very serious consequences for that government's
So
control.
We're just willing to close our eyes and let it go.
You know, I think the U.S. position on Pakistan is that there are a number of key issues there. They're obviously, U.S. officials who you speak to, intelligence and security officials, are of course concerned about the nuclear issue. They are equally, if not more, concerned about terrorism, and they see Musharraf as their best bet in trying to fight terrorism in that area. And I think it's a question of which lever do you push? If you push too hard on one area, do you risk losing your ally who's so crucial to you in another?
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye, John. Let's see if we can talk. This will be Lucas. Lucas calling from Portland, Maine.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
Thank you. A quick question. I'm curious about the role of the ISI currently in Pakistan. They've historically had a huge influence over, what's going on in Afghanistan and Taliban. I mean, they supported them for a very long time.
ISI is the equivalent to Pakistan's CIA, if you would. Mary Louise Kelly?
Right. ISI, Inter Services Intelligence, and it is, in fact, Pakistan's rough equivalent to the CIA. They, as the caller points out, they have a long and complicated history with their neighbors across the border, the Taliban and al-Qaeda. There are a lot of concerns that perhaps ISI at best turns a blind eye to al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and at worst is perhaps actively aiding and abetting them. And there have been a couple of recent studies out of the West. A RAND study, a big think tank just outside Washington recently, came up with a study saying that ISI is directly aiding terrorists, including al-Qaeda. I visited ISI headquarters there. I spoke to a number of senior officials. They adamantly deny that, as one might expect, and it's a very difficult thing to nail down. They remain very powerful within Pakistan. They are part of the military, and the military effectively continues to rule that country. And the president of Pakistan remains the head of Pakistan's army. So that raises, an interesting point, because a lot of people say ISI is powerful, certainly has historic sympathies. On the other hand, is not a rogue agency, is not an agency that's going to act in contradiction to President Musharraf's wishes. And Musharraf has publicly presented himself as a very strong U.S. ally in the war on terror. So then you get into questions of, are there perhaps individuals who are actively sympathizing with, aiding and abetting extremist elements, and senior officials are turning a blind eye? I think probably some of that is going on. The question is how high up the chain that goes. Hmm.
Lucas, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And before we let you go, what was it like as a woman reporting in Pakistan?
As a woman, not bad. As an American, it was very tough. I mean, as a woman, you have the experience that I think many women reporting from Muslim countries or Middle Eastern countries have, is that I had access to all the government officials and official interviews I wanted to do. I also had access to half the population that a male colleague would not. I was invited into private homes. I went out to dinner with Pakistani women my age and talked about their love lives and, how they go about choosing a boyfriend and will their family pick a husband for them, those type things. And those are incredibly interesting conversations that a man couldn't have. As an American, it was tough. I was really taken aback by the strength of anti-American sentiment in Pakistan.
How did it manifest itself?
Well, to give you a brief example, I had an interview scheduled with a professor at the University of Peshawar in the Northwest. This is one of Pakistan's biggest, most prestigious universities. I thought I was going in to have a chat with him and a cup of tea. Instead, he steered me into a conference room where a good 20, 25 faculty members, the dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, the chair of the history department, et cetera, were seated around a table. They had the press there, and my professor, the one who I'd come to see, sat me down and said, "I'll start the questioning. None of us believe that bin Laden and al-Qaeda were behind 9/11. We believe this was a U.S. government conspiracy to justify invading Muslim countries. Therefore, your invasion of Afghanistan was completely unjustified, and we're increasingly worried you're about to attack Pakistan. Respond." And I looked around, and all around the table, heads are nodding. I mean, and I spent 2.5 hours answering questions along these lines and thinking, my God, these are the educated guys. These are the guys with PhDs who are university professors who have access to Western press via the internet, and this is what they think. What do ordinary Pakistanis think? And that became a real focal point of my reporting, trying to find out what people think and why.
Mary Louise Kelly is NPR senior intelligence reporter. She joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to the next pieces in your series.
You're welcome, Neil.
You're listening to Talk the Nation from NPR News.